Hello, I'm John Woolley, and welcome to a special Forgotten Horrors podcast featuring an interview with Jackie Ray Naiman, the girl who played Debbie in 1966's Texas-lensed Manos, The Hands of Fate. We hope you'll enjoy this extensive behind-the-scenes interview with a star of one of the most notorious horror pictures ever made. Here's the interview. The first thing I'd like to know is, I don't know if you can even separate it now with all the time that's going on, but as a young girl, your initial impression of just what was going on around you when you shot it.
Well, my dad was in theater and he was an artist, and my family is quite bohemian, and my family was different than anybody else around us. My dad moved us to South El Paso, to El Paso, Texas, from Fort Worth when I was four, and started running the South El Paso Boys Club, which is literally on the Rio Grande River across from Juarez, Mexico. And they bought a house, a 100-year-old adobe house, 3 miles from the border. They say that Spanish-American Revolution, you could watch the battle going on from the porch of that house. Oh, wow. You could see, those were the days of Pancho Villa and going through that area. And what was the boys' club that they were doing?
What was his job? What was the boys' club?
He was executive director of the El Paso Boys Club.
Yeah. What is a boys' club? I'm not clear.
The Boys and Girls Club?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it used to be just the Boys Club until it became the Boys and Girls Club. But that was the 80s before it became the Boys and Girls Club. Okay. But when he was running it, it was just the Boys Club. And so it catered to the poorest of the poor, at that time, and all Hispanic families. And so my dad moved us to a neighborhood that we were the only non-Hispanic family in this entire community. And I was one of the few non-Hispanic kids in my elementary school. And we were just so different. I mean, because these people were so traditionally Catholic, but not just Catholic, border Catholic, which is almost on the verge of it's a combination of mysticism and Catholicism, almost like you would find in New Orleans, or other countries.
Right,
it was like
right.
a third world country growing up in the 60s. It was really, but my family was so artistic and so different that we not only our look, but everything about us stood out like a sore thumb. And so it was different.
So when you were in El Paso, were your dad and mom in the theater as well? Is that how they all met?
Yeah, my father was very heavily involved in theater even when we left Fort Worth. He was actually, both parents went to Texas Christian University, and she became an educator and he was a minister. And then he left the church. He was disillusioned, left the church, got into, the boys' club and working with impoverished children and families. But he was always involved in theater, even in college and in ministry. So he got involved with the local community theater in El Paso right from the get-go, and was a lead actor in many, many plays. And then when he left the boys' club, he became executive director of the theater. And that's where he met Hal Warren and William Bryan Jennings, who played the sheriff, and John Reynolds, who played Torgo. They were all together there in the theater. And Hal was like a minor bit player, but Hal had this idea to write this film, so he went where he knew he could find people that could help him do that, and committed people. I mean, theater people are traditionally very committed, even when they're on a project that has no hope. I mean, they're not going to walk out on you.
No, you know? Exactly.
And nobody did. You know,
the show must go on.
They stuck it out.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so this whole thing really, you could say, then came out of the El Paso Little Theater.
Absolutely. And all the women came from the local modeling school, Mannequin Manor Modeling School, which ironically, when, after my parents divorced and my mother remarried, my stepfather for my 13th birthday bought me, he enrolled me for finishing school at the Mannequin Manor Modeling School. So I was a 13-year-old little hippie chick and deeply resentful of being told I was supposed to turn into a lady now.
But you were getting ready to be one of the brides too, weren't you? I mean, just like the film said, you know, you were going to the place where all the brides came from.
Yeah, and that's so he enrolled me there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a little bit of firsthand experience with that place.
How'd that work out for you?
Well, my mother would drop me off every Saturday morning. I would wave goodbye, and as soon as she'd drive away, I'd go wander around El Paso downtown for the next 3 hours, and then I would meet up with the girls as they came out of class, and my mom would pick me up. I never went. I went a couple of times. I went long enough for the woman who ran it gave us a lesson on how to meet the Queen of England and wear white gloves, and I thought that was incredibly ridiculous, so I refused to go back. I'm like, but I did learn you never, ever turn your back on the Queen, ever.
You still, obviously, that was important. You still know it.
I do. Yeah.
All right. So, were you doing as they were involved in the theater? Were you, when you were very young? Were you doing theater as well?
I adored my dad. My dad was never home. He was deeply depressed. He was suicidal. Mm. And I found every opportunity to be with him and was very, very connected to him. So I grew up in that theater. I mean, I was either backstage or I was in the audience or I was in his studio watching him create. I mean, I have a keen sense of observation. I'm an artist. I always have. And it's interesting because my memories are so clean about it. And I've fostered those memories for so many years because it was the best summer of my life. And like, you know, people say, how can you remember things so clearly? And I say, well, think about like the best thing that ever happened to you in your childhood. You know, like if you went to Six Flags or the best birthday party or, you know, something really special. And that's what Manos was. I can't tell you any other birthday of my childhood what happened, but I can tell you everything about Manos because it was so special. I just soaked it up. And so I observed my dad on stage so many times, and that's how I learned to read. I learned to read so that I could run lines with him. And so I have very clear memories of my parents laying out the master's robe and designing it. I remember my mother making the wives' costumes. I remember why they added that red strip. I remember my dad making Torgo's prosthetic legs, you know, the things. My memories are clean, and anything that I might have been a little off on, I've had ample opportunity to talk to my dad, and it's interesting because I'll ask him something, he'll be surprised. He'll say, "Yeah, that's right. That's how it happened." You know. So I've had lots of confirmation, and I've become friends with Diane Marie. We've known each other for several years, who played Maggie, Margaret.
Right.
And so I've had a lot of opportunity to validate my memories and to clean up any little discrepancies that may have existed.
Well, what made that time for you as a 7-year-old, I guess?
I was six. I turned seven that summer.
What made it so special for you, that it's so crystal and still to you?
I mean, that's deep. I'm writing about it.
Okay.
And I'm getting ready to start. I'm talking to several people about just how much I should reveal on my blog. I'm really going into that personal space, because I think it's not just about saying what happened to me, but I think so many people can identify with difficult childhoods and these things with, you know, the energy between parents and children. But my dad was, I mean, he was my mother, father, you know, my mother was so invested in her education and her career.
What was she doing? What was her career?
She was a teacher, and then she became a homeschool, homebound teacher, and then she rose into administration, and she just loved education. In her 40s, she went back to school she got her PhD in psychotherapy, and she became a psychologist. And then in her 50s, she went back to school to Bright Seminary and became a minister. You know, I mean, she was constantly enriching herself. And
what was her denomination, Jackie?
First Christian, you know, Disciples of Christ.
Sure.
But my culture is Native American on my father's side, and his mother was very invested in that. And then I married a full-blood Native American, and my kids, we raised our children in those traditions.
But now, was your father also, when he was in the ministry, was he disciples as well?
Yes.
They were both disciples.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk then. We don't have to talk about the depth of it because you're going to reveal that later on. But let's talk about some of the superficialities, because there's a lot of, I guess, rumors that are around about the thing.
Seriously.
One is that it was made because the director and Sterling Siliphant, who later on became a very well-known scriptwriter, Route 66, a bunch of other stuff.
Route 66, and he wrote, he's the screenwriter for In the Heat of the Night.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So is that true? I'll just ask you whether that, you know, some of the myths that have grown up around your movie, is it true that it came about as a kind of a bet?
That's the general, I believe so. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows absolutely 100% for sure, because Hal is gone and his children weren't even born at that time. So they, you know, I mean, who knows? But I've done my own research on that, and I studied, you know, Route 66 and Sterling Siliphant and when he might have been in the area. And from what I understand, it's extremely plausible. And I believe that that's how it happened, that Hal and Sterling met, you know, like probably in a bar, and that Hal said something to the effect of, you know, I can write a movie. Anybody can write a movie. Look, you know, I'll make a bet with you. Who knows what the bet was, but the story is that Hal kind of wrote a little premise down on a napkin. And so when I started looking up Route 66 and learning that actually in 1961, because they traveled all around the country,
did,
it was a
yes.
very unique program
yeah,
in the
I
way
grew up
that
with
they
it, so yeah.
they took the entire cast and crew on location.
Right.
And they were in El Paso and Las Cruces area twice in 1961. Lee Marvin was in one of those, and Leslie Nielsen was in the one in Las Cruces, or Carlsbad Caverns, I think it was. Anyway, so I think the bet was made earlier, like around that time, and I think that Hal percolated this idea for several years. And if you watch the pilot episode of Route 66 and also the premise of Route 66, I find some real parallels there.
I never thought
and,
of that
And
before,
I think
yeah.
that Hal was heavily influenced by that program in writing his script.
I never thought about that before, but you're right. There's that whole thing with the car and America, seeing America and getting lost. And yeah,
Yeah, and that first episode, man, they get into this really creepy little town, you know, with really strange people, and it just makes sense to me, you know, if you know what to look for.
What was Hal's day job at the time? You know, some say he was a fertilizer salesman, some say it was other things. What was he at that time?
Well, it's entertaining to say that, and he was, but at that time he was an insurance salesman. And I can't remember off the top of my head which company he worked for, but he sold insurance, and that's also one of the ways he may have met William Bryan Jennings. Mr. Jennings was an attorney, but he was selling insurance on the side for extra income. William Bryan Jennings also had been working for the district attorney's office, and so had access to Judge Coldwell, who had the ranch where it was filmed. And so when you start picking these things apart, you can certainly see how all these things cross over and how all these connections were made. I mean, Hal obviously was a very intelligent man in terms of he may not have had the experience, and he obviously didn't, but he could find people to fill in where he needed those spaces filled, you know, people who would basically work for free.
Was it mostly on deferral then? Was that the idea, that they deferred the salaries until the film came out?
Well, Hal started selling stock in the film. And when the cast and crew got together after the handwriting was on the wall and what the hell are we doing here? You know, where are we going with this thing? They started comparing notes and discovered that Hal had sold something like, I forgot what it was, but like 600%.
Oh, wow.
Like, so, you know, people could see right away they weren't going to be getting any money.
Right.
My dad, I have the original contracts too. Yeah. And my dad provided the dog. The Doberman was our dog, Shanka.
Who was the Doberman were the only ones that got paid, correct?
Yes. I got a red bicycle with training wheels, and Shanka got a 50 pound bag of dog food.
I hope it was good dog food.
Nah, I doubt it. Seriously.
That came from Hal? Hal bought you the bicycle?
Yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So without getting into, I know that you're going to reveal, you know, more depth to it, but for a six-year-old making a movie, I mean, were you aware of what was going on?
More than you'd imagine. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I was very observant, and my parents were educated and very well-read. And they didn't really, I never felt like things were kept from me. I mean, I was exposed to this interesting world of art and culture and music and theater. And it was the mid-60s, you know, it was a completely different time. You know, my parents sent me to an experimental school when I was in sixth grade, and I flourished. It was trippy, you know, the principal smoking a pipe, and we called the teachers by the first names. And, you know, I mean, it was just a trippy way to grow up.
Yeah, I was in high school in 65, so I remember it very
well. You were what?
I was in high school in 65.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, so yeah. Yeah.
So I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know, there's people don't understand today. People don't understand who didn't live through it. How different it was. You know, you had sexual and cultural and social revolutions going on. You had civil rights, and here we are in this border town where things are backward. But I'm living in a family who's quite progressive and has sought out the. You know, we're kind of in this fringe culture. Quite aware. I do remember my dad coming home one day, and he squatted down. He looked me in the eye, says, "Honey, I'm going to make a movie, and they need a little girl. Would you like to be the little girl?" And I remember saying, you know, I was so shy. I said, I don't know. And I remember him saying, "Well, that's okay if you don't. We'll just get another little girl." And in my mind, like, hell no. You know, I mean, I instantly said yes because I recognized the opportunity to spend time with him.
Now,
and so that's why I did it.
Were you friends then? Was this the people who were in this film were from the little theater, more or less, except for the models?
Yeah.
Was this the circle of people that your family saw socially? I mean, did you know all of these people?
Well, John Reynolds, mm-hmm. I remember him a little bit outside of Monos because he was such a troubled young man. And my father had also was dealing with, deep depression. He recognized that in John. And as he tells me, he really tried to engage John and to help him. He'd invite him to family things and he would try to do things socially with him. But John was just so reticent and, he was just such a closed person that he never took my dad up on any of those requests. But during the filming of Monos, I was left to my own devices. People were busy and there was nobody there to babysit and we're out in the desert. So what's going to happen? I might get bit by a snake or stung by a scorpion or something, but I grew up in the desert. So nobody really was worried about that. So I was left on my own. And during downtimes, I distinctly remember John being the one person that paid attention to me and hung out with me. He was so shy that he felt most comfortable, I think, with a six-year-old child.
Must have been very hard for you then when he died by his own hand before the film was previewed.
Yeah. No, I remember that day distinctly. My mom was teacher at Ben Milam School on Fort Bliss, and the Army base. And I went to school there because she was a teacher there, even though we weren't military. And we were on our way to school on a Monday morning, and it came on over the radio. And my mom just pulled right over, and we sat there in the car while she kind of absorbed but I remember that. It was just tragic. I mean, my family was really, my dad, I think, probably held a lot of guilt because he had tried to befriend John and help him. And then this happened and he identified with him because of his, depression.
Well, and plus his theatrical stuff as well. Plus the way he expressed himself and his creativity.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was exactly, 1 month to the day before the premiere. So John never, although, what's interesting is in recent interview with my dad, every time we're interviewed together, I learn more. Mm-hmm. And I learned this time that, because I'd always denied this. People said, well, Monos contributed to John's suicide. But people would say things like the rumor was that John wore the leg braces inappropriately and that they caused such pain. He became addicted to painkillers and therefore committed suicide. And I'm saying, well, it was filmed like in 8 days. How quick do you become addicted to painkillers and kill yourself?
Exactly.
It doesn't happen like that. Yeah. And that's a cultural reference. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People saying, prescription drugs. That's what people do now. They didn't do it then.
Exactly right.
It wasn't the drug of choice.
No.
And so I think I forgot what the question was.
Well, we were talking about him and the idea that of the leg braces and all.
Oh, right. So my dad said that he just said this like 2 weeks ago. I was pretty surprised, and I asked him again. I said, "Really?" But he said that he feels that John was such a perfectionist. And even though there was a lot of drug use, John and my dad were both method actors. And the script was, everything was just, they knew it was going down this path. They knew that they were not on a good project, but they were committed to finishing it because that's what actors do. And my dad feels that John was so humiliated by this whole thing that it actually did contribute to his suicide.
Well, now, whose idea was it for the leg braces? Was that Hal's idea?
Hal's whole thing was pretty shallow. My dad crafted the leg braces. My dad says, you know, they wanted Torgo to be something different. And, as you know, the whole Igor thing, the hump thing, that had been done. So what do you do, you know? And for the sake of budget and time and everything else, you know, John Reynolds' entire costume came out of my dad's closet. I mean, John was like 5'8", and my dad was 6'3".
Oh, wow.
So those were his welding. My dad, as an artist, he had his welding stuff. Those were his welding coveralls. Mm-hmm. And so he built the braces out of wire and foam and, upholstery foam.
Oh.
So they were cushioned, for sure. They weren't comfortable, but
right. He
was never meant to be a satyr.
Right.
It was just, that's something other people made up. That was never true.
Your dad, I guess, is the one who created that robe, or your mom, I don't know which, created that robe with the hands, which is so striking.
Yeah, isn't it beautiful?
Oh,
I mean,
beautiful.
I see it in the restoration, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, and who created that then?
My dad designed it, but my mother was an excellent seamstress. She made all our clothes, and so she did all the construction. And I have a very clear memory of them laying it out on our wood floor and creating it.
Right.
I remember them making it.
A couple of other questions. I know one that I've just that are myths or that are things that are said about the movie. One is that because they dubbed all of the dialogue afterwards, that you actually cried when you heard your dub for the first time. Is that true?
Oh, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just having that come out of your mouth?
That was the premiere. I didn't.
Oh, was it the premiere?
Nobody told me. Yeah. I mean, we're sitting in there in the premiere and we're all dressed up and in the beauty parlor. Felt like for 2 days to me, it's probably just a couple hours, but, you know, people tugging on my hair and putting on that dress and all that stuff and the whole pomp and, you know, I mean, the whole premiere was made up to be such this huge thing. I mean, Hal had convinced everybody that Manos was going to be the movie to open up the film industry to El Paso. I mean, he was a salesman for sure.
So it was debuted in an El Paso theater?
Yes, the Capri Theater downtown, November 15th, 1966.
That was a pretty big deal. Searchlights, and what did they do?
Searchlights, red carpet, limousine, one limo. Cast and crew were instructed to arrive, and we waited around the block, all dressed up, and the limo came, pick up a few people, drive out front, deposit us at the red carpet.
Uh-huh.
Go in, cameras clicking. Hal hired a couple of these little Mexican kids, you know, that didn't even speak English. The street kids, the one that wash your windows and sell gum, you know, to make a living for their family. I mean, these kids are poverty.
Yeah.
And so he hired these kids for who knows what he paid them, not much, but gave them little – I've got pictures that show these kids in this as people are getting out of the limo, these little kids are there with their little pads of paper and pencils. They're autograph seekers. I mean, they didn't even speak English and everybody in the cast is white. You know, it just made no sense. So we're sitting in the theater, you know, and nobody had seen it. And my dad said he positioned us, his family, kind of, you know, center, not too far from the front so that we could see. He wanted to see it, right? And the lights go down and it begins. And it was just from the moment that, you know, the audience is dead silent. Then you hear laughing, then cat calls. I mean, it just got worse and worse. And so I'm sitting there as a child. All I'm focused on is me. I just want to see me. And the first time my mouth opens and I hear that voice come out, I was so horrified. I just burst into tears. And all I remember is just crying the whole time. I hardly saw the film. It was just terrible. Nobody told me.
Right. No.
But I got over it. I'm okay.
Well, I'm sure the rest, nobody told the rest of the cast either, did they, that they were going to be dubbed?
Well, all the men pretty much did their own voices.
Oh, they did. I did not realize that.
All the women were done by one voice actress in the sound studio in Dallas, Texas. They drove, what is it, like 600 miles?
Yeah, long haul.
800 miles from El Paso to Dallas. I think it's 800 miles from El Paso to Houston, and Dallas is, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth. So they drove to the sound studio. It was Hal, my dad. John Reynolds was still alive. He went. And William Bryan Jennings. So four men, and they all did their own voices. And then they hired this voice actress who did all the women, including me.
Now, I know that was the film that everyone remembers that you were in, but I have credit for you in a film called Curse of Bigfoot. Did you?
Yeah. Yeah. That was in high school. I went to Montclair High School, and
that's El Paso?
Southern California.
Oh, okay.
East of Los Angeles. All right. I was living with my dad at the time. My parents had divorced, and my dad moved to California, and I went to live with him and went to high school there. And my drama class, my drama teacher knew somebody, and they were looking for some extras for a classroom scene. And our class was picked. So we all went in on a Saturday for this scene, this classroom scene. Curse of Bigfoot's interesting because it was first started in, I can't remember what year, it was like 1958.
It was real early, yes.
And then it was shelved, partially done, and then somebody found it and decided to finish it in 1976, I think it was. I think I was a junior in high school.
It came after that Legend of Boggy Creek when that whole Bigfoot thing had started getting hot.
Yeah, that must be it. Yeah. Somebody went, hey, you know,
yeah,
let's
we got this partially
finish
filmed.
This film.
Sure. At what point did you realize in your life that Manos was a big deal to a lot of people?
Well, you know, growing up after Manos, everybody was just kind of went their own ways.
Sure.
I mean, they didn't really speak about it again. Nobody went, you know, it was something they did, and nobody went, they didn't like have a cast party or get together and talk about it. You know, everybody has just kind of like disappeared.
Right.
And, I mean, Hal actually kept almost everything that my dad did except some of his sculptures. My dad did all the sculpture in the film, you know, all the hands, he titled the film, you know, Manos. It was originally called Lodge of Sins, and then it was going to be titled Fingers of Fate. But my dad suggested Manos, Hands of Fate, in a production meeting because he was asked to be the artistic director, and he already had all this. He was his hand phase. He already had all these sculptures. So really, the only things he made for the film was where the fire is, you know, at the, you know, where the wives area and the slab is.
Right.
That thing where the fire is, the hand he made, the John Reynolds hand that he caught on fire. He made that for the film, and the painting, of course, over the fireplace. He made that. And the costumes, but everything else pretty much came out of our house. You know, most of the furniture.
Uh-huh. So you found out that people were, I mean, that there was a cult around this picture.
I spent my whole childhood from my teenage years, I never forgot about it.
Sure.
But we never saw it after that. We didn't have a copy, you know, nobody had home video.
Sure.
We didn't have a 35 millimeter, you know, we didn't see it. we saw it in the theater, and that was it. And so my high school friends still say, I remember you talking about that. I would tell my friends, yeah, I was in this movie with my dad. And that was it. I searched for it. I looked in film libraries. I looked at universities. And it was nowhere. So in my 20s, I gave up. And then I got married. And one day in January 1993, my dad was living on the Oregon coast, and I was living in Northern California. And he called me one Saturday, and he said, you'll never believe what I just saw. And he was watching, he's a Mystery Science Theater fan, and he was just kind of lazing around on a Saturday afternoon watching TV, you know, rainy Oregon day. And he was napping, and he heard some music that sounded oddly familiar. So he opened his eyes, and he saw himself. Wow. And he was just stunned. And here's an interesting sidebar is that Brian Jennings, who's the son of the sheriff, was away at college during the filming, and he never saw it. And he had just checked into a motel room on the Oregon coast, just in Gold Beach, just like 3 hours from where my dad was physically at that moment. And he walked into the motel room and turned on the TV, and there was this grainy underwater looking thing going on, Mystery Science Theater. And he was about to turn it off, and all of a sudden his father stepped out of the police car, and he knew instantly what it was.
Wow.
Because his dad had told stories around the dinner table for years, you know, so he knew what it was. He'd never seen it. My dad called me and said, you know, you're never going to believe this. By then it was over. So I turned on Comedy Central, and I knew that I copied down the 800 number, and because they had an 800 number. It said for info call. So I called. And I got a hold of this guy who said his name was Matthew, and he was in the HBO offices in Manhattan. And I said, you just showed a film I've been looking for my whole life. My family was in it. And is there any way I can get a copy of it for myself, for my family? And he asked the title, and I told him, and there's this long pause, and he goes, oh, my God. God, are you Debbie? I mean, that was my first inclination that anybody besides my family had any interest in this whatsoever.
Right, right.
So after that, you know, those were the days, the early days of home computers, personal computers. And as soon as I started getting online, and I started finding people talking about it here and there. And I started reading these ridiculous rumors and stories. So I started back then by just kind of chiming in and saying, you know, this isn't true, and this is why I know, you know. I'm Debbie, my dad is a master, and, you know, I can tell you that's Diane did not die in a fiery car crash, you know, things like that.
Now, that reminds me, one question I did want to ask you that is a rumor is that the reason that the voices had to be dubbed was that Hal used cameras that could only do a certain amount of film, like a few seconds or 30 seconds.
Yeah,
of film,
I think it was like 36 seconds mm-hmm. is what I understand. But, yeah, they didn't have sound. But Hal didn't – I don't know who he told. He sure didn't tell – I mean, why would they tell me? I was just a little kid.
Sure.
So I just remember Hal always telling people, and me included, keep going. It's okay. We'll fix it in editing. You know, it in the lab. He always said, we'll fix it in the lab. So – you know, me being an observant child, I knew I wasn't speaking loud enough, but he never really gave us the opportunity for second or third takes. And I've learned recently it's because the cameras were rented. There was only so much film. And so Hal shot everything pretty much. Rarely there was two takes. And so by the end of it, there was nothing to edit out. I mean, you couldn't to have the length of the film, that 78 minutes or whatever it is, He really couldn't cut anything out.
Sure. Yeah. They shot without sound. MOS, right. As they say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes
a
lot of
sense.
So
that was his intention all along. Whether most, you know, the cameramen would know. My dad probably knew. Mm-hmm. John knew. But the wives probably didn't know. I didn't know. You know, It's the 60s. You know, women don't need to know that kind of stuff. Don't worry about it, honey. Don't worry your pretty little head.
So starting in the early 90s and now for 20 years, it's kind of been gradually going on. And if you can tell me, we're kind of at the end of the interview. If you can tell me, then you actually at one point have established a website about it. You've got a show. There's a lot of things going on. So what Monos-related stuff are you doing now?
It's insane. I mean, in March, I was asked to do a play in Portland, Monos Hands of Fate, which is incredibly, hilariously funny. It was like a parody on Monos. And Brian Cook, who put that together, found me. He heard I was in Oregon. He contacted me and said, could you do this? And I did. And so I ended up... Debbie was played by a doll on stage, and I voiced Debbie from the light booth. So it was poetic justice. I got to do my own voice for the first time in 47 years as a middle-aged woman. It was just brilliant. And interesting, when he wrote it, he didn't have any idea that I could, that I was available.
Right.
Or, you know, it wasn't his intention, but it worked out remarkably. Hands of Felt, Monos Hands of Felt was in Seattle last month. And
that's a puppet thing, right?
Puppet. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, that was funny. God, belly laughingly, amazingly brilliant. And I got to go up to that. I did Q&As. I've been invited to several places. I've been to the El Paso Film Festival, been to Los Angeles Independent Film Festival in Hollywood, and Seattle at the Seattle Independent Film Festival for screenings, for Q&As, and the audience enthusiasm and response has been fabulous. So the restoration is taking off, and I'm looking to do more traveling, and this came up last night, but I may be doing a talk show on a new Portland radio station coming up soon.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm writing a book,
mm-hmm.
And my blog, it's Debbie's Monos. If you just Google Debbie's Monos, it comes up. I'm thrilled to say that, that on Google, I'm on page one at the bottom, right. But I'm on page one.
Good for you.
So, but you can pretty much, if you just Google Jackie Ray or Debbie's Monos, I come up for my website. I have an Etsy site. I'm a professional artist. And so I'm doing a lot of work now, some Monos inspired work. I'm selling, you know, autographed, premiere photos and t-shirts and such on eBay. Just got, you know, building things. We didn't get paid, so I'm trying to help my dad out too. We're just trying to find our, you know, mostly it's for fun, but it would be nice to benefit a little bit.
Absolutely.
From it too.
You're doing the work. It would be great to benefit from it.
It would be awesome to benefit.
one last question for you. What is it? I'm sure you've had a lot of time to think about why Monos? I mean, there's been so many films made. There's been so many low-budget films made.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, you know, you think of Plan 9 from Outer Space and some of the, as maybe an analog or something. But why Monos? Why do you think there's so much interest in the picture now, however many years it is after you made it?
Well, my dad and I had... We were just bewildered by it. We had no idea why, but the fans have really educated me on this, and I'm starting to understand better that it was the times, you know, you're going from this nuclear family of the 50s and then this amazing social cultural revolution into the 60s and the sexual revolution, and everything had changed so rapidly. And so now when it comes out, it's like anybody with a telephone can make a movie. You know, anybody has video But in those days, it wasn't like that. You know, I mean, you really had to plan it. And Hal was this guy that had this idea, and he made it happen, regardless of the fact that everybody knew very early on that this was a complete train wreck. And yet they continued and they finished it, and he promoted it, and they did it. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. And I just love that it's still known as the worst movie ever made, because everybody knows there's a lot worse movies out there.
Goodness,
there's
yes.
a lot of really crappy stuff out there that's unwatchable. But Manos has – it's just a combination of so many things, that heartfelt – these people that are just going for it with all their heart no matter what. Mm-hmm. And they did it. They actually did it. And then it gives people hope, because it disappeared completely for over 20 years. And then out of the blue, Mystery Science Theater, because they thought it was so horrid, they almost said it was too horrible. They weren't going to show it at all because they were embarrassed. But when they did, it just caught fire. I mean, something about it, people just take to heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the fans... the people I've met are the most amazing people. My dad was a little freaked out in the beginning, going, what are you getting yourself into? But I've met the most creative, amazing people. They're the best people I know, is the Manos fans. These people.
Yeah, they probably recognize what you're talking about in the picture. Those are the kind
of
people who would, you know?
Yeah, this is the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, and family healing, it just goes deep. It goes real deep.
Our sincere gratitude to Jackie Ray Naiman, the star of Manos, The Hands of Fate, for talking with us in this special Forgotten Horrors podcast. Please remember to check out Jackie's stuff online and to check out our stuff online, the Forgotten Horrors series of books, specifically on Amazon.com. On behalf of Forgotten Horrors founding writer Michael H. Price and producer Joey Hambrick, I'm John Woolley. Back at you soon.